If I fell in love with you, would you promise to be true and help me understand? 'Cause I've been in love before and I found that love was more than just holding hands.
Welcome to I've Got a Beatles podcast with Dave with you today, and I am pleased to have an interview with Andy Leach, who is the Senior Director of Library and Archives at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio, and also all-around knowledgeable source on rock music, and he's got a very interesting background of music history and library and information sciences at all different sorts of places like the Center for Black Music Research, as well as the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. So I'm pleased to welcome Andy to the program.
Well, thanks, Dave. It's really great to be included on this great podcast.
And you started out with a great song. As our listeners know, I always ask our interview guests to pick a couple of songs that are meaningful to them, and so you chose "If I Fell." And what does that song mean to you? As we're actually recording on John Lennon's 77th birthday, and
that's right.
Very much a John influenced song.
Absolutely, yeah. I guess I picked "If I Fell" for a couple reasons. One is that I just love the harmonies. You know, they're just the way the vocal lines move around each other. I think it's just like it's just a nearly perfect song in terms of the harmonies. But another part of it is I've just been, for the past week or so, as we record this, it's been a week since the passing of Tom Petty, and I've just been really, I was really upset about his passing. And I've just been thinking about him a lot and listening to his music. And, part of why I picked this is I was thinking about how, Tom was influenced by the 12-string Rickenbacker that George was using in A Hard Day's Night, the film, and I was just thinking about that film and just watching some clips from it, and just thinking about Tom and George and the fact that they were later in the Wilburys together, and it was the Tom Petty connection maybe more than anything.
Yeah, and that we were talking a little bit before the program. He was 66, and things happen when you live a rock and roller life, but it still seemed more surprising than some of the other recent deaths in rock music, and especially for Beatle fans. Tom Petty was such a George Harrison fan and friend that is such a great connection that meant a lot to all of us, so definitely something to think about. And of course, John Lennon, as well, being not with us, and this being his 77th birthday, what does he mean to you as in your work or as just a musician? Or
yeah, it's funny. I guess over the course of years, you kind of think about who's your favorite Beatle, and John, and for me, I've had different favorites over the years, but John, I guess, just in terms of the way his sarcasm and his humor, I guess just the way he stood up to forces that were oppressing people, and he's kind of an inspiration in that way, but obviously musically as well, his songwriting, both as a Beatle and as a solo artist, are just, that have always meant a lot to me.
Yeah, and the one time I've been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was to view a John Lennon exhibit some years ago, and it was really had a whole room of lyrics, I remember, as well as lots of artifacts and clothes that he was wearing, and sort of the good and the bad and the ugly side of things. And it there's just so much. I mean, John was such a complicated figure that I think you never get bored of him or his music because there's so many angles to look at. And so I thought that was a really effective presentation and exhibit there. But, you know, I wonder how, for those who don't know much about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, how did it end up being in Cleveland, and how did it even get there so we could even see these sorts of things?
So the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was officially founded just as an entity back in 1983. And then, as many people know, and this is kind of how most people think of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it started inducting inductees in 1986. Many of those first class included Elvis and Buddy Holly and the Everly Brothers and Chuck Berry, Little Richard, and all the greats. And I'm leaving out some, Fats Domino. But for a few years there, they're inducting folks, and always, you know, from the beginning, there was a vision that there would be a museum where people could come and, you know, learn about the history of the music and be engaged by it. So basically in the late 80s, or I should say the mid 80s, there was a lot of cities sort of petitioned to be the site of this museum. And basically Cleveland just had the biggest response. The city leaders really put together a plan that financially worked as well. So between just the enthusiasm among Clevelanders and the, like I said, the civic leaders kind of putting together a plan that worked where they'd build a museum and it'd be financially viable. That was it. And, you know, and Cleveland historically has justification for kind of being called the home of rock and roll, and one of those reasons is that Alan Freed, the DJ of the 50s, he was the first person who coined the phrase rock and roll as a musical style or as a musical genre. So he got his start here, and there are a lot of other reasons why Cleveland is important in the history of rock and roll, but that's sort of the main one that is cited.
How did you end up, because I said your background, and true confessions here, Andy and I have known each other for a very long time, going all the way back to the University of Illinois. When you were back there studying library science and working there, how did you end up getting to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and what are the main aspects of what you do?
To start off, I mean, part of what got me here was, as a young kid, my parents had records at home, and one of the ones that really hit me when I was, I mean, as young as 4 or 5, was they had the Beatles' Greatest Hits, the Blue Album, the 1967 to 70. Mm-hmm. And then the first vinyl record I ever bought was the red one. Oh. So when I was a little kid, so I just absorbed the Beatles, and I was just into music from the time I was a kid, and I played guitar and I played other instruments like in marching band and concert band. That all led me to become a music major in college, and that was at the University of Illinois, like you said, and that's where I met you. I think probably maybe our junior, senior year, maybe even earlier. And so while I was at the University of Illinois, I started working at the music library. And you probably remember when I was working there. And I was there for 3 years, like from sophomore to senior year, I was working part-time at the music library, and just, I loved the atmosphere there, and I loved the people that worked there. And I liked just interacting with people who, were either musicians or music students, and just being around all the books and recordings was fascinating and fun for me. And then I kind of got out of college and ended up working just part-time jobs and was playing in a band. And then while I was there, I realized, oh, the best library science program in the country, according to some, is right here in Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois. So I thought, well, I may as well, do something with my music degree and try to combine it with this, and maybe I can be a music librarian somewhere, So I did that, and then I ended up at my first job out of grad school was the Center for Black Music Research in Chicago, which is part of Columbia College. I was there for 8 years, and that all led me kind of to this. And so in about 2008, I saw a job description for Director of Library and Archives at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I thought, oh, okay. I thought I had my dream job here at the Center for Black Music Research, but oh, that's my dream job. I just realized that's what I've been working for toward this whole time. And long story short, I applied and interviewed and got the job, and I was like, yeah, I've made it, man. This is it. This is like my dream job. And 8, 9 years later, almost, it still is. Wow. Just I can't believe it sometimes. So, I guess I was trying to tell you a short version of the story, but that was a bit long.
No, it's interesting because you mentioned something that back in not all that long ago when we were at, well, it seems like a long time, but the University of Illinois, when I would go into the listening, like to listen to something, I would actually have to physically get a CD or a record or check things out. Now, obviously, things are so different in terms of how we hear media and listen to music and stuff. So what do you think's been your most surprising find in the time since you were a student to where you are now, pros or cons or in terms of your, what you've seen that's really revolutionized or changed the way we perceive rock music?
Wow, that's a great question. Yeah, I mean, I was just, as you mentioned that, I was thinking about the listening rooms as well and how, that's in those 3 years as an undergrad, especially having access and working at the music library and just going through the vinyl and taking the records into the listening rooms. And in some cases, that was the first time I ever heard a lot of Neil Young records or even just, they had this, the University of Illinois Music Library had such deep vinyl collections when it came to pre-war blues and country and just stuff that I still don't think you can find online. Like the other day, I was just thinking, oh, I'll look up these Dillards, the Dillards, a bluegrass band that kind of got into country rock later. Anyway, I think the first time I'd ever heard them was listening to them at the University of Illinois on vinyl. And I think I was looking something up the other day and I couldn't find the particular record that they had. So, I guess to get back to your question, I guess it's interesting the kind of instant access to almost everything you can think of. It's great. I love it. I'm streaming music while I'm driving in the car and just like anything I can think of. But in some cases, it's there's nothing to replace the physical act of browsing a shelf of records and pulling them out and looking at the track listing and the liner notes and the lyrics and just going back to what I mentioned, those two Beatles greatest hits records when I was a little kid, the red and the blue, I would just stare at those for hours because the lyrics were in them too. And so I just stare at the photos and just, that's how I still think of that when I listen to those songs. And just, I don't know, the instant access to everything, like I said, is great, but you just lose a lot somehow. And sometimes it's better to browse a shelf than it is to, to kind of just go cold into a search, box. Like, well, I don't even know what I want to listen to, but if you've got the ability to kind of search a physical collection, it's like, oh yeah, I haven't heard this George Harrison record in a long time. So I'm going to hear that now.
That's really funny because I was thinking that even recently because with the students I'm teaching, sometimes I feel like there's just the fact that everything is available, it's so overwhelming. I sometimes look in the search box. I don't even know what to look for. Like, it's just sort of like, well, maybe I won't listen to anything because I don't know what I'm listening to. There's just so much, you know, everything's available. Pros and cons, I think. It definitely made things easier, I'm sure, in the library, but it's also, you lose some of that curiosity and the excitement of finding a new thing.
Right. And I just remember, not to get away from the Beatles too much, but like, I remember when I worked there, persuading the librarian, the music librarian at the time, please buy this box set by the Louvin Brothers. And because I was somehow, I'd heard about the Louvin Brothers, I heard a couple songs, and I'm like, yeah, these guys, and I read about them, and I'm like, these guys are important. You got to buy this box set. And they had to order it, you know, and I think I found it in a catalog, you know, printed catalog. And it's like, I waited for this thing to arrive, and I just sat in the listening room at the music library and absorbed the whole thing. And I still love those guys. And it isn't really getting too far from the Beatles because they influenced the Everlys, and the Everlys influenced the Beatles, so the harmony singing especially. I still kind of reminisce about that, like you said, just searching and finding something, you know, and then putting it on. It's just like, yeah, I miss it, but I don't necessarily want to go back to that era either, because I just love that I can, you know, pull my phone out of my pocket and then listen to that whole box set from the cloud, you know.
A lot easier, yeah. Well, so obviously in the library there's a lot of older type materials, and I'm curious, in relation to the Beatles here, when were they elected to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and then what would you say are the most significant, we'll go with the exhibits in the hall first, and then we'll talk about what is Beatle-related in the library. So when were they elected, and then exhibits and the library?
They were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1988. That's what I was thinking. And that was absolutely the first year they were eligible because, they were it's basically the rule for induction is that you have to be – it has to have been 25 years since your first official – I believe album recording.
Okay.
And so that probably this was voted in, well, I guess, yeah. So between 63 and 88, it's 25 years. So, 1988. And, I believe only George and Ringo, showed up for the induction ceremony, but they were you know, all four members are inducted that year.
Yeah. That was a big scandal. I remember I think you can watch some of it online. George spoke and Ringo spoke, and I think Yoko was there. Paul wouldn't show up for some reason. He just kind of made a big scene about it, and George said something very George, like, we all wish Paul could have been here, but he's got other ideas, other things to do, or
right. Oh, but yeah, he did. Yeah, obviously, Paul was later inducted as a solo artist, and then he even inducted John himself. So he was able to come to a few, and he actually inducted Ringo few years ago, which happened here in Cleveland.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So what sorts of things can we see if we go to the hall itself?
Yeah, so right now... there's a great Beatles exhibit. It's pretty extensive. I mean, compared to, you know, what a lot of bands, the space that a lot of bands get, but there's essentially like a really cool room that is devoted to the Beatles. And then on the other side is the Rolling Stones.
Oh.
It's really great. One of the things that just when it first arrived and was installed in that space, right in the middle of the room is basically Ringo's drum kit from then. It's really his primary drum kit that he used between 64 and 68.
Wow.
So, and you can walk all the way around it and just look at it from every angle. And it's just like the first time I ever saw that thing, I just like every hair on my body just sort of like was stood on end. It was like, oh man, I can't believe I'm standing here in front of this. And it's been there, sitting there for a few years now. I believe, I think it got there when he was inducted, which was in 2015.
Okay.
But also, next to that, is one of John Lennon's Mellotrons, which is pretty
nice.
Cool to look at. And you can walk all the way around it and kind of look in the back of it and see all the stuff that's, you know, that are inside the Mellotron, the tape loops and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's like, you know, and he used, obviously they used a Mellotron famously on Strawberry Fields Forever.
Yep.
And
flying too, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, yeah. You're right. So otherwise, yeah, there's some cool guitars. Some of these get moved around like into other exhibits. Like for example, we had our last major exhibition, in a different space in the museum was on rock and politics. So John's, I think it's an Epiphone Casino. He played on the rooftop, you know, Let It Be, but also on Revolution. So that's why it was in the Rock and Politics exhibit. But so sometimes that is down in this Maiden Beatles exhibit. But right now, I know that his Rickenbacker that he obtained when they first came to America in February of 64. It's a Rickenbacker, I think 325. Yes. That you would know this, I think.
I have that one. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I remember when you had that guitar in college, and it's like, man, I loved playing that thing.
Oh yeah,
but,
very cute.
But yeah, not the same guitar, folks. Not the exact same guitar. But a reissue.
Yeah.
but he apparently he didn't play it on the first Ed Sullivan show, but he got it when he. Like after that, and then he played it on the second Ed Sullivan show appearance, which was shortly thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of guitars that are cool, but and some cool jackets and suits worn by pretty much each of the Beatles, and you know their handbills and also some records, and it's just a really great exhibit. But the guitars do it for me, especially.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Oh, and then the handwritten lyrics to some kind of major Beatles songs like "Lucy in the Sky" and "In My Life." Just it's just like that still gets me every time. Just seeing essentially it's like the back of an envelope that John wrote the lyrics of "In My Life," and it's like it's just gets me every time.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on in the museum, and of course. I don't think we mentioned it yet, but our library and archives, which I oversee, is a couple miles away. Mm-hmm. So we opened to the public in 2012, whereas the museum's been around since 1995. At our library and archives, a few things to mention. We do have a really cool, we don't have any donations directly from the Beatles, but we do have, for example, one thing I think is worth mentioning is this letter and some drawings from Stuart's that were done by Stuart Sutcliffe.
Oh, interesting.
Huh. Yeah. So I think this was all from about 1961. It's a letter from Stuart to his sister in 1961. And it's, you know, this is only, I think, several months before he died.
Yeah.
And it's kind of just talking about how he's doing. This is after he's already left. He's not in the Beatles anymore, but he's still friends with them. And there's even a mention in there of maybe when we get together, we can go see the Beatles. and there's also a drawing of Stuart in this sketchbook, in these four portraits that came from a sketchbook that was a drawing of him by John Lennon.
Oh,
so that's pretty interesting. Also in the archives, I kind of like this woman, when I first got the job, so just within a month or two of that, this woman reached out, and this happens a lot, just people who are collectors or just regular people, as well as people in the music business even. But this woman was actually at the show in Cleveland here in September of 1964 when the Beatles came through, and this was at Public Auditorium here in town. And she gave us a DVD of basically footage she took from her seat with an 80mm camera. And there was during that show, so it's a silent film, obviously, and there's not really that much in terms of duration. It's just it's a few minutes, but it shows when the police shut down the show because the audience was getting too crazy. So you kind of see the cops on stage and the Beatles leave, and then apparently they came back on stage a little bit later and finished the set because the police were able to kind of convince everyone to settle down, or we're not going to let them continue. Yeah. You know, I guess something to mention on John's birthday is that we have a really interesting, it's basically a time capsule. It's essentially like a big metal box that's been welded closed. And what happened was there were three of these that were created on his 70th birthday. So that was October 9th, 2010.
Yeah, exactly.
And so Yoko and a guy she was working with to create these, they put these three time capsules together on John's birthday. And what's in it, essentially, I saw what was in it because I was here that day. It's all of his recordings on CD. And then a CD player has been put inside, and then because the idea is this is going to be opened on his what would have been his 100th birthday, which will happen on October 9th, 2040. So and there are letters from Yoko and Sean and fans, and so all this stuff is kind of put together in this time capsule that we have that we are to open on October 9th, 2040. So
wow.
I'm not sure I'll still be here. I'd have to do the math, but I don't think so. But anyway, yeah, we'll open that up and hopefully it'll all still be in working order, you know, the CD player and everything.
That's pretty exciting. So you actually saw it? You got to see what was in it?
Yeah, before the guy welded it shut, I actually was sort of trying to place things in a way that, you know, so nothing was kind of sitting on top of another thing. And so it's just sort of tidying it up before it got welded closed. And now it's sitting on a shelf in our archive. So when I bring VIPs and artists and you know, people who are potential donors and guests, when we bring them through to give a tour of the archives, that is like the thing that people see more than anything else and always ask, what is this? Because it actually has basically it's etched in the front of it is a drawing of John himself, like a little sketch. I'm sure you've seen it, but it's done by him.
That's,
you know, so it's
sort of with the glasses.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So,
wow,
yes.
Cool.
But, you know, there are lots of other Beatles and solo Beatles related stuff within various. We have about 500 collections now that are processed and available to anybody who wants to come in for research or to educate themselves. And so you might find, if you search, you'd find stuff on him in various collections, probably 100 different hits of documents or photos or audio or video within various collections.
Wow. Well, I'm curious, how do you contextualize or archive such iconic figures like the Beatles, especially when there are two who are still alive? And is there kind of a challenging situation to archive living musicians versus somebody like Elvis? Well, I don't know, maybe Elvis is alive, but let's say Chuck Berry, who just died, someone who's not with us anymore. Do you find there's some challenge in archiving or deciding what you want to take or putting things into context?
The interesting thing is with people of that level, I mean, I've never dealt directly with a Beatle and I'm sure never will, but they have people that do that.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm just trying to think of somebody a little, a little less kind of untouchable, or kind of, you know, somebody who's a little more kind of accessible.
Yeah.
So like when I've dealt with some artists, a lot of them kind of aren't really thinking in terms of archiving their life, because there's a lot of these guys are still, and women are still working and performing music and recording. And I just don't, it's often not until maybe the end of their lives, or even like you're kind of getting at, after they're gone, it's then that sort of you're dealing with a family who, and sometimes, maybe trying to convince them that, hey, this is the way you can preserve the legacy of, you know, your family member who's gone, is to have it preserved properly in an archives where, it's going to be stored in, climate controlled storage, and it's going to be organized and, arranged and understood by our archivists and presented to future researchers or to the museum for exhibits, or, you know, to educators for educating students about the history of rock and roll. So it's often, you try to do it with somebody who's alive as well, but also sometimes with people who, are the heirs to the, of those folks after they're gone. So I would say, yeah, it's challenging in both situations, but I think once we get artists or their families here at the museum or at the library and archives and show them kind of what we do here and how we understand the history and how we do what we do every day, they kind of get it and see, oh, okay, yeah, I do have stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, you know, this is important. Because I think what sometimes happens is, one of the greatest things that ever happened to me is I actually did meet Chuck Berry.
Oh,
and
nice.
He came to this library and archives. It was like the greatest day of my career.
Yeah.
And I spent a day or two kind of thinking about, looking at his autobiography and looking at the stuff that his, you know, that we have that represents his heroes. So Big Joe Turner, Nat King Cole, you know, not all those guys, Muddy Waters, people he actually, he knew and loved. And that's, I think that really got him, you know, like, and that's what gets all these guys. Everybody's a fan, all these musicians, of course, even our inductees, even the rock royalty, like Paul and Ringo, they're fans.
Mm-hmm.
Of course they are. So, you know, they want to see stuff with their, if they see things that represent their heroes, maybe then it's when they think, yeah, I, you know, my stuff should be there too. And that's where it could be preserved. But, so that's a long answer,
it's very different. I think for people, the whole perception of rock and roll has changed from when it started, where it was seen more as a kind of an ephemeral music that wasn't, you know, popular, industry driven, or going out and you wanted to make money and meet girls and all of that, until it switched to become more of actually take a scholarly interest in preserving it and its impact on society. And I think that's, that I can imagine it would be a really interesting situation to be in, to be, you're making this music and then all of a sudden someone says they want to put it in a museum. It's kind of a weird feeling, I bet.
Yeah, I mean, I think for some musicians, it's not true for every artist I've ever met, but some of them just think, well, yeah, that's stuff I have. It's not that important. or it's just something that's like never would have crossed their minds. Like, oh, yeah, I guess I could go on exhibit, or that could be preserved here at a library where people could come and research it. So yeah, it's different for all of them. And I think especially like the guys who are still making albums and writing songs and out there touring, you know, they're still working. So they don't really, a lot of them, I think, just kind of think, well, I'm not a museum piece. I'm still around.
Yeah, I mean, Ringo just released his 19th solo album, and he's 77 years old. So
yeah, amazing.
It is. Well, speaking of Ringo, that's a good segue into our middle song here. We're going to take a music break here. And you chose a song that features Ringo pretty well on it, Ticket to Ride. So let's listen to it, and then we'll come back and hear what Andy thinks about it. Ticket to Ride there, had to let the music go through the little guitar lick. So so what do you like about Ticket to Ride, or what stands out to you about that track?
Well, I guess I picked it for a couple reasons. Again, I mentioned Tom Petty earlier and his connection with George, and this song just starts off with that beautiful 12-string Rickenbacker and features it throughout. But yeah, mainly it's because it's right now it's my son's favorite Beatles song, and it's because of that drum beat. Because my son's 10 years old, and we got him a drum set earlier this year, and I'm actually astonished at how good he already is. And it's just from playing. I get the guitar and the amp, and he's playing the drums, and we were just playing together all the time in the basement. But he really likes that drum beat. and you know, I think it's justified. It's like one of the greatest features of, you know, Ringo's playing, and it's just one of the coolest drum beats there is.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, as you know, it was featured prominently in the movie Help, and I was wondering if the library has any significant stuff on Beatle movies or the solo career, since you've talked about some of the stuff in the museum itself. But can you think of anything that would be interesting to point out about those topics?
Yeah, well, especially the first thing that comes to mind about films is we do have this interesting yellow submarine cell. It's like essentially a celluloid, which is means it was actually used. It was literally one of these pieces of celluloid that was painted, and this particular one has John Lennon and George Harrison in it from the Yellow Submarine film. So it's a drawing of them, and it was literally one of the frames. Wow. That was used in the film. So kind of cool. And I think I should have looked this up ahead of time, but oh yeah, so I think it was actually owned by Paul McCartney, allegedly, and was given to an artist in the 70s. So it's possible this was actually owned by Paul McCartney at some point. So that was used in the Yellow Submarine film. In terms of solo careers, yeah, again, probably anything related to the solo Beatles is all going to be, we have a lot of books, yeah. Magazines, you know, fanzines and sort of fan newsletters, and then we have sort of, you know, just commercially released recordings, both, you know, CDs, records, DVDs. So, and then in terms of archival stuff, if you were to search for, you know, John or Paul or John or George or Ringo in our catalog, you'll probably find lots of small stuff about them within other collections, which could be a folder full of photos. It could be biographical info that was put out by, you know, in press kits back in the 70s, or, you know, could be even archival video or audio recordings of them in concerts, that sort of thing.
Well, it seems like there could be a lot of rare stuff or valuable things. So how can people access the materials in the library, and do you have to have a scholarly letter or any sort of credentials, or can any Joe off the street come in?
Any Joe off the street can come in. Anybody can access basically anything that we have here. It is by appointment. So you just have to let us know no less than a day before. So if you call us or email us and you see something in the catalog and you want to see it, just let us know. We'll bring it out to you in our reading room. It's you don't have to have any particular credentials, other than just any kind of photo ID, whether that's a driver's license or a university ID or something, whatever. And then we have you fill out a registration form. We give you a library card that you can bring the next time you come. And you have to leave your coat and your bag in a locker. We have camera surveillance and we have a security officer, you know, who's there at the door, but it's not too scary, you know, but you can still, it's because we have those security measures in place that we're able to provide access to this stuff. And that's the whole point, is for it to be used and for people to be able to learn from it. So, like I said, it's free. It's open to everybody who wants to come and use the Rock Hall Library and Archives.
That's really great, because I know I've, in my other life as a music theory professor, that when I've done research in libraries, sometimes it's like you have to go through 8 levels of security and white gloves and the whole thing, and it feels very unfriendly. This is very good that you have that accessibility policy.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of it is that we know that we're responsible for a subject matter that is kind of important to almost everybody. So we know that our clientele isn't just going to be academics or educators. You know, it's going to be it's going to be students, music fans, people who are writing biographies or doing documentaries or just folks who want to come in and read some magazines, you know. So if we try to make it as easy as possible while still having, like I said, the security and safety kind of in place that keeps all of our stuff safe and secure.
Right. Well, I want to finish off with a question about you a little bit, since we go back a long ways and played guitar and sung a lot together. So you're a very good guitarist and singer. What impact has music of the Beatles had on you in your playing and just the way you compose, think about music or whatever? You've already alluded to that a little bit about that, but I'd love to hear more if there were particular songs or guitars or anything that really influenced you.
As I mentioned at the beginning, those two greatest hits records that were around when I was a kid, in the late 70s, early 80s, I was listening to those like crazy. And then it wasn't until probably high school, really, that I was, you know, and this was after the, each of the Beatles albums came out on CD. So I, you know, throughout probably junior, senior year of high school, I just went out. A friend and I both kind of split up duties. Like, you buy Abbey Road, I'll buy, Magical Mystery Tour, and eventually we had all of them. Then we take this was back in the cassette, almost like the CD and cassette days. Yeah. So we kind of put together like a whole complete works of the Beatles on cassette between the two of our CD collections. And I just you know, they'd already been my favorite band like as a kid, but I didn't really know all the entire catalog until then. And then, you know, probably around the time I knew you, the anthology sets came out. And, yeah, just absorbed all of that. So I would say, maybe just musically, I want to say more than anything, this might sound surprising to you because I'm a guitar player, but I think, you know, I've been in bands for like 25 years, I guess. And I think vocally, I think harmony singing, I learned it from Paul McCartney more than anything. And I think I also kind of got into country music and folk music around the same time, and in college especially, and just absorbed like bluegrass singing and stuff. But I think, yeah, probably more than anything, just the way they, you know, like I said earlier when we were listening to If I Fell, I mean, nobody sounds like that. And just the way they harmonize and kind of the way they didn't necessarily have a lot of vibrato, just straight singing, you know, just and just this, when John and Paul are a fifth apart, it's just like, oh yeah, it's nothing like that.
Perfect.
I would say more than anything, just I learned how to sing listening to the Beatles and listening to the harmonies, and then yeah, the guitar playing, definitely. I mean, I think just the sounds, you know, like I talked about the 12 string, and I think the guitar playing on Abbey Road especially is just pretty exquisite.
It's amazing to hear the development from playing those early rock and roll tunes, and I saw her standing there all the way to Abbey Road, and just hear that development of, especially George in particular.
Totally. And I always love, you know, of course, the end where the three of them are trading off solos, and you know, of course, I really just thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever heard when I was in high school, and it's still, I still think it is.
Yeah.
Just, yeah, that's done. Yeah, that sounds like Paul. Oh, but that's George. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Well, this is a perfect way to close out our interview here, because you mentioned the singing, and so we're going to listen to Two of Us for our final song, and I'll ask you about that after you tell us how we can get in touch with the library and Rock Hall of Fame and all that, the website and contact info.
Yeah, absolutely. So everybody, if you haven't been to our museum, you have to come, and you need to spend a whole day, at least a whole day here. So check us out at rockhall.com. That's rockhall.com. And then for the library, it's library.rockhall.com. And like I said, we're a couple miles away, but we're all part of the same institution. And we're here to support the museum as well as to be open to anybody who wants to come in. So yeah, those are the two websites. From our library site, you can find a way to contact us, but you can, if you want to write this down, it's library@rockhall.org is our email address. So anytime, just send us an email.
Perfect. That sounds great. So, as I say, we're closing out today with Two of Us. So great song from Let It Be. And what stands out about this? Why did you choose that tune?
Well, you know, I was also just kind of thinking about harmonies in general, because that's why I love the Beatles so much, especially. And, yeah, part of it was that you and I, I'm almost ready to sing the song because you and I. But anyway, you, Dave, and I used to sing together. We'd get together and play guitars and sing. And, of course, pretty much all we sang together was Beatles songs.
Yeah.
I think you had a book even, so we could like pretty much find any, look at the lyrics and chords for any of the songs. But yeah, I'm sure we must have sung this one. It just makes sense that we would have. But I like it because it's, you know, it's about John and Paul looking back at their time as young men kind of just hanging out and being great friends. And so, yeah, I think it's fitting that we're kind of like that. You and I too are kind of like looking back at back when we used to sing songs, and you know, it seems like that's the way we should end this, is to listen to two of us and reminisce about the old days.
Yeah, I couldn't say it any better, and I wish I had my guitar here and we'd do it live, but we'll let John and Paul take it away here. So
They could probably do it better than we can.
Probably. I think we'll go with them. But in any case, I want to thank you so much, Andy Leach, for speaking with me and speaking on the podcast, and encourage everyone to go visit you at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the library.
Thanks, Dave. I really appreciate you having me on. And anytime, man, I'll come back anytime you'd like.
Sounds good. Well, let's go out with two of us, and I will be back with Chris, and we will talk to you again soon.